So we're going to be shifting into our teaching time together, and I want to invite you to add your two cents to this. We want to hear from you in the comment section for the two. There's going to be two primary discussion points that we want to hear from you to kind of get us talking this morning. We're talking about defining moments. We're starting a new teaching series called Aftermath, and it's pinpointing pivotal defining moments in five stories from Scripture of lives that were transformed by the resurrection of Jesus. And we're going to look at how their transformed story challenges and transforms and reinvigorates our own. And so for us, what I want to hear, what I want to talk about is moments that are pivotal or transformational for us. Because we all have those moments that we remember every detail of, where we were, who we were with, but more than anything, how we felt. So I want around the circle to hear some people. It doesn't have to be necessarily personal, though those are always good too. It could be cultural or just something that happened in society. But tell me about a moment or an event that you consider to be pivotal or transformational. Why was that moment significant, and what did it change? So let me hear from you. Let me give you an example, maybe. Maybe you need to hear an example. For years, people would ask the question, where were you when JFK got shot? The assassination of President Kennedy resounded in people's memory. It was pivotal. The moon landing is another. 9/11 changed everything, and I'll never forget that day and the emotions that came with it. So those are some examples to kind of get your mind thinking, but what might be one, for you that you, would consider pivotal, both culturally, and personally?
I was just thinking about, that faithful, youth leaders conference.
Yeah. yep. I know where, the one.
where several youth pastors, including, youth pastor Jordan at the time, I was there with them and just explaining my my feeling that, like, I was taking every vacation that I had and any time that I had off and was just spending it time with youth, with youth events at camp, just doing things with the youth. And it was, I was like, but it didn't feel like it was enough. And so two things happened during that time. One, I sat through a seminar where there's this guy who he's a youth pastor at a fairly large church in the South. And he also was the CEO of a company. and he was full-time youth pastor and the CEO of a decent-sized company. And I asked him, like, how do you do it? And he's like, well, you have to make a decision. What's more important? And then you have to follow through with that. Mm. And then explaining to my friends, you know, Jordan, Tim, Aaron, you know, this feeling. And they all kind of gave me the same look and were like, this sounds familiar. I think you're being called into the ministry. And
actually, I think my words were, I know what that is, but you're not going to like it. I think is exactly how I put it.
So yeah, no, that obviously completely changed my life. I mean, at the time I was a programmer for a credit union. My outlook was, you know, to continue in that. I was being groomed to become, you know, the, not manager, but the team lead for that group. I was engaged to Sarah, and we were talking about the future of our life.
Right, you can stop taking the answer. There's a reason we talk about these questions beforehand, and you didn't
well,
see
do you
sharing
wanna,
this.
Do you
so, want to
jump
onto
that?
Yeah. You
want to
finish?
No, you can finish. You can finish.
Yeah. Marital bliss, okay. Folks.
go okay. Ahead, please. All right, this so part I guess, involves you.
Right.
Yeah.
He has a tendency to talk for me when I can talk for myself.
I love you.
So for me, when I was thinking about, you know, what moment was pivotal, quite a few, you know, different things that came to mind, like just little things. But then I really started to think about it. And for me, it was that the moment that Franklin told me he was called into ministry. I had been at college finishing my first semester of grad school for physical therapy. And he got this calling in February, I think. And then all it was there's something I need to talk to you about. And he didn't talk to me about it till May after I was home.
Oh, that's right. I remember this.
And so I didn't want to mess up her graduate school.
I surprised him for lunch that day because he was still working. I knew what time he worked. So I went and got subs from Wegmans. We miss Wegmans. and we enjoyed subs like by the river. It was nice. And Franklin was planning on telling me that night, but I like kept nudging because I'm like, you said there's something you want to tell me. And so he told me that he was called in the ministry. And we were only dating at that time.
Yeah.
We weren't engaged yet.
Yeah.
So and he told me this, and my immediate reaction was to run. I think we'd been dating for at least a year and a half or so at that point. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just wanted to forget that last year and a half of my life, because I knew that this calling placed on his life would also be a calling placed on mine. And I didn't think I was ready for it. I was like, I'm not meant to be a pastor's wife. I don't want to be a pastor's wife. I have plans for my life. And this kind of completely changes that. So after many tears, plenty of counsel. Again, shout out to Jordan and Jen, especially Jen.
Yeah,
I could not
definitely.
Have done it without her. And then probably, you know, for the next year, I definitely wrestled with it. And then God did show me that this was also the path that he had for me as well. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Kind of makes the example I was going to share feels much less pivotal than that. But Barb, Nick, do you guys have any examples of pivotal moments, whether it's that deeply personal or something less?
Oh, I can get super personal.
Of course you can.
Take a
Oh, you think you're personal?
You know, on a completely different note, maybe a more darker note. my relationship issues in the past, and you know, my ultimate divorce. I was at an extremely low point in my life. The lowest I've ever been, and in just a random chance encounter in that, I came here for the first time. It was the first time I've been to church in years and years, and you know, and it was just a huge change the first time I came, and then I haven't stopped coming since, and it's been 2 years. And it was such a dark moment for me, and coming here and experiencing God, and it's like a whole other family, and it just really, it was a huge pivotal point in my life.
Absolutely.
And it got me out of that dark place, and I thank God every day that I've been able to experience that.
Put a pin in that. I want to come back to that. Yeah, this is good. Great. Hold on to that one, because this is going to inform a lot of where we're going to go. Barb, do you have any thoughts?
I do, actually. I have made some not-so-good decisions in my life. And at the time, I didn't realize how bad a decision I had made, but at a basketball game, I ran into somebody I had worked with before, and she mentioned, I go to church in Katyville.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, okay. So I said, sure, that's great. And as things started to really get difficult, I came to church here in Katyville, and some 12, 13 years later, I'm still here.
Wow.
And the way I look at that is God knew I needed him, and I needed to be close to him and to have a church family. And through that brief encounter with somebody that I knew from way back when, he brought me here. And like I said,
that's
I have
cool.
an amazing church family, and I am so glad that God has blessed me with this church and this family, because I don't know where I'd be without them.
Amen. Wow, you guys got far more personal than my example. Because they know this, because I sent them kind of a preview, because my example of a pivotal moment was hey guys, the iPhone was released in January of 2007, which doesn't quite have the emotional punch, but I mean, we'll come back to that. But I mean, let's be honest. It's interesting, and I think, you know, you mentioned, actually, at least the two of you, I think you guys definitely understood from right away, but sometimes even in the moment, we don't always recognize how earth-shattering something would be. You know, the introduction of the iPhone was in many ways the first, at least widely accepted smartphone. And few people, actually, a lot of people mocked the design and still mock the design. But realistically, they had no idea the success that the iPhone would be and the changes that would spur on. Because I was a hardcore BlackBerry enthusiast back in the day. My dad worked for the company that made BlackBerries. But whether or not you like the iPhone, it is impossible to argue that smartphones have irreparably changed the world. The world is different now than it was in January of 2007. That was a pivotal moment in the course of the world. And when we look back on it, we see the impact that that moment had. So whether or not for you, you're looking back and you're seeing a moment in your life that you're saying, this I knew at the very moment that it happened, this moment changed my life. This was a pivotal moment in my life. Or it's something that you look back on and say, wow, I can't believe that changed everything. Whether it's personal or just cultural, something larger. I want to see in the comments below, would you share? You don't have to get as deeply personal as some of us did. You can go the safe Jordan route. It can be on this continuum. There is no judgment here. But please, we'd love to hear from you. What is a moment that has been pivotal in your life? Because we all have those moments in our lives and in our culture. They come to define us. They impact us. They transform us, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. We look back and we remember crystal clear a wedding day, the birth of a child, the day we got our driver's license or when we started losing weight. These are pivotal moments, but we also remember the day our house burned down. We remember the death of a loved one. We remember a divorce. But we also remember some of the smaller things. The first time we tasted Ben and Jerry's. The first time we had rainbow sprinkles. The first time we smoked a brisket. Your life was changed forever. I'm sorry, I was getting a little off track. I'm a little bit hungry. We remember those moments, whether they're big or small, whether they're earth-shattering by design, or they become important because of the impact that they had. And I think we'd be hard-pressed to find a more pivotal moment in history than the resurrection of Jesus. No other event in history has had more impact on the world than this one event. And I know that it's not Easter Sunday, that was last weekend, but every Sunday is a mini Easter. Every week we proclaim the resurrection of Jesus, we celebrate that our God is alive, and we lift up the name of the resurrected King who is resurrecting me. In that first Easter weekend, the followers of Jesus experienced two pivotal moments. They experienced one on Friday, and they experienced one on Sunday. Now, on Friday and Saturday, these moments were devastating. We shared that last weekend because they, even though Jesus talked a lot about the fact that he was going to die and rise again. If you read the Gospels, one of the questions I hear often is, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, how dumb were the disciples? But, I mean, number one, humans can be obtuse sometimes, and you know that. If you're a parent, just think about your children. They can be, not that they're stupid. Your kids aren't dumb, but let's be real. Okay, not going to go there. But for whatever reason, whether it was intentional or not, Jesus' closest followers did not comprehend that Jesus would rise again. So the weekend after his death, they were locked in an upper room. They were mourning the loss of their Messiah. They were devastated because they had put their hope in this Messiah, and Messiahs weren't supposed to die. They were afraid for their lives. They were terrified that they were going to be the next ones to die. And the story of those followers, when we think of them, we tend to think of the disciples, the 12, or as some of the children last week said, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, even though only two of them were the disciples. But the followers of Jesus in the stories that tell this, the story of those who were closest to Jesus, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, actually, tell us that it wasn't just the 12 that were with Jesus. In fact, there were many people that were close and traveled with Jesus on the regular basis. In fact, in Luke 8, we see that soon afterward, Jesus began a tour of nearby villages and towns, preaching and announcing the good news about the kingdom of God. And he took his 12 disciples with him. Those are the ones that we're familiar with. Along with some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Among them were Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out 7 demons, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's business manager, Susanna, and many others who were contributing from their own resources to support Jesus and his disciples. So his bankrollers, interestingly enough, were a cadre of women. It's something that you may not have realized. But the person that I want to zero in on here is the story of Mary Magdalene. Of the list of people that I shared the names, she would be the one that you recognized. And I want to kind of make a couple of notes on Mary Magdalene. First of all, isn't it amazing just how many Marys there were in the Gospels? I mean, it's kind of hard to keep them straight. I mean, you have Jesus' mom, you have Martha's sister, you have the Magdalene one, you have the other Mary. Like, there's a woman in the Gospels literally just called the other Mary. That's it. That's all we know. There was like 47 Marys in the New Testament, and I only remember, like, I can keep 3 of them straight, and that's it. And in popular culture, Mary Magdalene, many people think they know her story. I even assumed that I knew her story. And when I started preparing for this message, I was like, well, I'm going to go and find her story, because I knew the statement that Jesus had delivered her from being demon-possessed, and I'm looking for it. I'm like, I don't actually know where that is. And so I went on to my Bible app, and I searched Magdalene, and all of them were from the story of Jesus' resurrection. And I'm like, what's going on? All we know about Mary Magdalene is summed up in that one sentence from Luke chapter 8, verse 2. That is it. We weirdly enough, throughout Christian history, we have accused Mary of a lot of things unnecessarily. She has been called a prostitute and a sinful woman, at very least promiscuous, if not an outright prostitute. She's been kind of conflated as the woman that washed Jesus' feet with her tears and dried his feet with her hair. We have no reason to believe any of that, because I'm assuming people are referring to the book of John, the woman that was caught in the act of adultery. Sometimes I think people assume that was her. Neither of the women that are referred in the book of John have a name. They're nameless people. And so I think it's easier for us to ascribe a name. But all we know about Mary is found in that one verse. This is Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out 7 demons. And for us, that doesn't tell us much. I have never had a personal encounter with somebody who was demon-possessed. I don't know if anyone else has here. Didn't think so, at least as far as we're aware. We could talk about some people that it's possible. But most of us, if you're watching at home, it's likely that your only experience or your only knowledge of demon possession probably comes from the 1973 movie The Exorcist. Or maybe Buffy the Vampire Slayer might have had some from the late 90s, early 2000s. I don't know. But we don't know much about it at all. It is very foreign to us. In fact, most preachers don't like to talk a whole lot about demons at all because it feels so foreign to our culture. But we know that Mary was relieved of her possession by Jesus. And we don't know much more than that. But hearing that sentence would have spoken volumes to Luke's original readers. In fact, in Luke 8, Luke goes on to tell of another person who was possessed of demons that encountered Jesus. And we learn a lot about the portrait of what a demon-possessed person would have looked like. And believe it or not, while I would not recommend it, especially to your children, The Exorcist actually gets some things right about at least the understanding, the biblical understanding of what it means and what the effects of somebody who was demon-possessed. In Luke chapter 8, we learn several things about a nameless person who Jesus encountered. We learned, number one, that people were terrified of them. Most of these demon-possessed people, and even in popular portrayals, they are out of control. They are violent, unpredictable, wild. Mark and Luke describe them as strong. They're otherworldly strength. They are often outcasts. They are not able to live or exist in society. And there is even a sense of a loss of identity. The man in Luke 8 isn't called by his name, but called by the name of the one possessing him. He is Legion. That is not his name. That is the name of the one who is possessing him. And from our understanding, or at least the popular understanding of the time, the story of this man was the story of people who were possessed. That story would have been Mary's story. Demoniacs, as they were called, weren't considered people anymore. They were monsters, and they were treated as such. Mary would have been a complete outcast, beyond any hope of redemption. Nobody would have approached her, and she may have lived, like the man in Luke 8, among graves. And the only reason that was acceptable is people did not go to graves. It was a very different world than we are used to. People would have avoided her at all costs, being afraid to even touch her, but not Jesus. Jesus saw past what had Mary, what possessed Mary, and saw her. Saw who she was, recognized her for who she really was and who God created her to be. He met her at her lowest point and transformed her story. And this wasn't the first time that Jesus met people at their lowest point. He made a habit of it. In fact, he was scandalously known for meeting people at their lowest point. A woman caught in a scandalous affair publicly, a tax collector who was known as a traitor and a thief, a woman with a promiscuous past, a man with a contagious skin disease, a foreign woman who had been rejected by 5 husbands. It was Jesus' M.O. It was his defining characteristics. It's why when you read the stories of Jesus' life, it's why swaths of undesirables flocked to him. Because Jesus made a habit of meeting broken people and transforming their story. He'd meet them at their lowest point and bring them hope. Their encounter with Jesus was their pivotal moment, and they would never be the same. Jesus knew their story. Their every heartbreaking twist of the plot, and he still offered hope. Jesus would even reveal to them that he would understand their hurt, that he'd see their pain, and he would still extend the transforming hope of a fresh life and a clean start. That is who Jesus is. That is what Jesus does. And it's what Jesus is still doing today. Jesus is still reaching into our story of brokenness, meeting us in that moment and transforming our story. Nick, you earlier were sharing about that dark time, and I remember that day well. You were here picking up a pair of glasses.
Yep.
That was not how I would have expected. I call it our meet cute. but you were sharing about how you met Jesus in that dark time, and I'd like to maybe just extend that a little bit. I don't know if there's anything that you want to add to that story, but I kind of want to just open it up to having several of us share about a time when Jesus met you in your brokenness. I realize we've all kind of shared a little bit of that, but I want to just open it up to a little more discussion about how Jesus has transformed your story when he met you in your brokenness. So I just want to open that up there. I don't know if you have anything else you want to say on that. I'll give you first right. You can also lean in and awkwardly say no, sir,
no, sir,
like you did last week. But I want to just have let's talk a little bit more about that.
It was, you know, in that dark time, he so much was opened up to me. I mean, coming to church more often or at all was it's huge. But I mean, that chance meeting with you also when I came to pick up the glasses got me back into music, which I hadn't played music since I was in school, let alone anything Christian.
Right.
And then in that dark time, you know, I firmly believe God helped me meet the person I'm with now, who has been a huge positive influence on not only my life, but my walk as a Christian too. And, you know, all that combined, coming out of the lowest point in my life so far is just extremely significant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Somebody else, when has Jesus met you in your brokenness?
I just think about the period of, you know, probably 6 to 7 years after my house burnt down. You know, we were homeless for about a year. And then just a lot of brokenness in my family afterwards. And, you know, God showing up so many ways. It's amazing that I didn't realize my call to be a pastor much sooner.
It's funny how that works.
Because, you know, there are so many moments where now that I look back, it's clear that either, you know, God was there to protect me or that Jesus was meeting me in certain moments. You know, I had, you know, during that time, you know, my house burnt down. I also had a relationship that I was engaged and had to break that off. My church fell apart because of indiscretions of my pastor, who I looked up to for most of my, and just every time after that happened, God brought someone in my life to kind of be the broken glass that drew me back into Christ's light, and to show me that, like, no, this isn't what's defining you. This isn't who you are.
Yeah.
This is just the next step.
Absolutely.
And it, you know, there was a lot there. A lot of crazy stuff happened during that time.
I know some of this story.
But seriously, time after time, Jesus showed up. You know, several different churches I ended up at, several different people I ended up meeting who were just lights in the darkness when I wasn't either necessarily looking for Christ or looking for a light. It showed up in front of me and kind of brought me back to where I needed to go.
Absolutely.
It's always when you're not looking.
Yeah,
quite often.
Yeah, when you're looking for a pair of glasses.
Like when you're looking, actively looking for a light, it feels like you can never find it. But it's when you stop and that's mm-hmm. when it comes, you know.
Actually works that way often enough with my glasses, so yeah. Comes full circle. Somebody else, how has Jesus met you in your brokenness?
I think for me, I think looking a lot back at my teen years, a lot of my brokenness was kind of self inflicted.
I know that story.
In some ways, I grew up in a broken home where my dad left our family when I was, I think, in third grade, if I remember right. And it just, I think that broke me, and that obviously wasn't something self-inflicted. But after that, I just spent so much time just looking for, like, the love and attention and just looking in all the wrong places for that. And multiple times God, you know, brought me to my knees, brought me, you know, to that point. And, you know, I would listen to him for, you know, a certain period of time, and then I'd go my own way again. And then it was after another broken relationship when I was in college that really, I think that one brought me to my knees the most. And I just remember when that relationship ended, just laying in bed and God just saying, like, you know, you trust me with all these things. Like, can't you, you know, trust me with your relationships? And I think that was a huge turning point for me at that point. I was actually looking earlier in a journal from that period of time because I really felt God, like, saying, you need to just, like, devote time to me. And I was at college at that point, and we had a labyrinth garden. And so I just would go down every evening and just sit there for half an hour. And it was just really cool the ways that I experienced God, even through deer. We lived in my campus was kind of in the country, but kind of still in town. And I just remember the one night a deer just showing up. And I went for a run you know, a time after that, and another deer showed up. So then I really started digging. and so then that's when I was brought to Habakkuk, where he talks about giving us the strength and the to tread on the heights. And
yeah,
I think so it was through all that brokenness that God really brought me back to him and to really understand his love for me.
Absolutely. Barb, do you have anything else to add? I don't want to cut you off.
No. I guess just the other thing I think about, and it surrounds my church family, is I made a lot of poor decisions in my life, and I really struggled with them and tended to isolate myself.
Sure.
And through my grandchildren and now through my work here, God keeps saying, no, that's not where I need you. That's not where I want you. And with my grandkids coming to church with me, like Emmy, and coming here and giving her life to God, God's showing me how he can work through me when I'm out there for him, when I'm here with my church family and things. And that just, I just try to focus on him every single day, because that's where my hope lies, is in my faith. In him.
Yeah. No, I think for me, the most challenging, I think, that I would call my most broken would have been the year following my graduation from college. You expect, when you graduate from college, you expect to get a job in your field. And so, of course, like, any person that planned on being a pastor, and that's a whole story, some of you know, but the opportunities didn't seem to be materializing. Typically in Wesleyan churches, it happens in the summer, you know, June, July, and I remember in August just being in a really dark place. I was getting married in November. I kind of had this idea of I would be, you know, working for a church and serving people, and none of that was happening. I was working in a call center, taking billing calls for a natural gas company in Ontario, and I was not having it. And naturally, what happens in those times is you start to question everything. You know, have I just wasted the last 4 years of my life? Did I get this call wrong? Was this the right decision? Was I in the right place? Did I miss something? And, you're asking all these questions. And I think it was the first time that August that I ever, not that I ever felt God speaking to me, but that I felt God ask me the question, do you trust me? And this has happened multiple times since then. This sense of God asking, do you trust me? And I've had to say, yes. At least I'll say yes. And I had this sense of him asking me, will you trust me even if this doesn't go the way you plan? And it was this overwhelming sense that I had to wrestle with, and it wasn't easy, and it wasn't a one night thing, but over the next several days, I just felt this shift in my thinking, this shift in my outlook, that in that low point in my life, Jesus was there with me and saying, listen, I love you, and I've called you not to be a pastor first, but to be my child first. The Apostle Paul says, I consider all else, everything else, every religious experience, every religious pursuit, I consider it trash compared to the glory of knowing Jesus, not the glory of being a pastor, the glory of being apostle, the glory of being evangelist, but the glory of knowing Jesus. And that's the first time I think I ever really discovered the joy of knowing Jesus for the sake of knowing Jesus, not for the sake of what it can bring me. And that, I don't know if that would be the lowest point in my life, but it certainly was a low point. And as we find that first Easter, again, it was Jesus' MO of meeting people at their low point. Mary didn't just have that one pivotal moment, she had two. She had her first encounter with Jesus when she was delivered, and she had an encounter with Jesus at the tomb. You see, Mary was one of the brave few people who actually stayed with Jesus during his execution. Mary would have been counted among those who mourned Jesus' death and feared for her life, and all of the Gospels count her as one of the first people to see the empty tomb. But in John 20, she sees the empty tomb, but she's convinced not that it was a miracle, but that it was a grave robbery. And Jesus tells of her reaction and her devastation. In verse 11, it says that Mary was standing outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she stooped and looked in. And she saw two white-robed angels, one sitting on the head and the other at the foot of the place where Jesus' body had been laying. And they asked her, "Dear woman, why are you crying?" And she responded, saying, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they have put him." And she clearly, even then, is not recognizing the miracle. And she turns to leave, verse 14, and saw someone standing there, and it was Jesus, but she didn't recognize him. And he asked her, "Dear woman, why are you crying? Who are you looking for?" And she thought he was the gardener. "Sir," she said, "if you had taken him away, tell me where you put him, and I will go and get him." And it's amazing, at this point, Jesus had already transformed her story. Jesus had already transformed the world's story. Jesus, who had been brutally executed just days earlier, was alive. But Mary didn't recognize. She didn't recognize him. She didn't recognize that the situation had changed. She didn't recognize the whole world was new. Mary didn't recognize the miracle until Jesus said one word. Let's go back to verse 15. She said, she thought it was a gardener. And she said, "Sir, if you've taken him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will go and get him." And Jesus said, "Mary." And she turned to him and cried out, "Rabboni," which is Hebrew for teacher. Jesus could have said any number of things to open her eyes. Open her eyes to who he really was, to open her eyes to the new world in which she lived. He could have done or said anything, but he knew that all he needed to do was say her name. All she needed to hear was Mary. It's likely it was the same name that he had said to her all those years before, when everyone was afraid of her, when everyone avoided her, when she was a social and religious outcast, when her identity was tied to that which possessed her, when the world saw a broken, deformed, ugly, terrifying monster, Jesus saw her. Jesus spoke her name. And here at the tomb again, Mary's world was crashing in around her. She had lost all hope. Not only was her Messiah dead, but somebody had desecrated his body, stealing it from its place of safety. Mary now was at the lowest she had been since she first met Jesus. In fact, though they say it is better to love and loss than to have never loved at all, I'm sure Mary did not feel that way, having found and then lost her Messiah. Grieving for the injustice that she now felt was even more intensified by the fact that somebody stole the body of Jesus. And it was at this lowest point that Jesus re-enters her story. It was at this point that hope was restored. Because Jesus saw Mary and he said her name, and she knew that everything was different. And Jesus isn't finished meeting people at that point. Just as we've all shared, Jesus emphatically declares those who are broken, those who are wounded, those who are grieving, those who are outcast, those who feel worthless and valueless. He declares that that is not the reality as he sees it. That others may believe it, that you may even believe that about yourself, the world may even reinforce that, but Jesus combats this thinking and declares us wholly and deeply and dearly loved. One of the stories that Jesus tells to reinforce the way he sees us is my favorite parable that Jesus tells, and it's also one of his shortest. In Matthew 13, he is telling a metaphor that compares the kingdom of heaven, a Hebrew shorthand for the kingdom of God or just God himself. He compares the kingdom of heaven to a jeweler in search of the finest pearls. And he is searching and searching and searching. And in Matthew 13, he says, when he found a pearl more beautiful and valuable than any jewel he had ever seen, the jeweler sold all he had and bought that pearl, his pearl of great price. And Jesus makes it clear, you are that pearl. That is you. That is me. We are the pearl of great price, the pearl that he is willing to sell and to give everything to redeem, to make his own. Even though we are all broken in some way or another, the beauty of the story that Jesus tells to Mary and to so many others in the scriptures, and the story he tells to us today, is that your brokenness does not have to define you. That your brokenness does not have to be the limit to your story. But like our name so captures, and the reason that we chose that name is that Jesus shines through our brokenness and illuminates beauty through it. Author Lance Witt once wrote, "You are more broken than you know and more loved than you can imagine." Jesus sees through our past, even sees through our present. He sees through what you've done and sees through what's been done to you and calls you by name. People are awfully good at defining us by what we've done. But Jesus defines us by what he's done. And he's offering us a fresh start, a new beginning. He gave Mary a new story twice And it changed everything for her. Mary was the first to proclaim the good news that Jesus was alive. She found the disciples and declared, "I have seen the Lord." Once again, Jesus reclaimed her story, and it changed everything. And Jesus wants to reclaim your story too. And he wants it to change everything again.